Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, President Obama repeated that he would not negotiate on the Affordable Care Act to avoid a government shutdown.
The House Republicans are so concerned with appeasing the Tea Party that they've threatened a government shutdown or worse unless I gut or repeal the Affordable Care Act. I said this yesterday, let me repeat it. That's not going to happen.
And it didn't happen. At midnight, the government shut down for the first time in about 17 years, automatically furloughing about 800,000 federal employees. If you work on the space station, you're in luck, I guess. Joining us now to talk about some of the nuts and bolts of the shutdown and later on the politics of it all is Columbus Dispatch Washington Bureau Chief Jack Torrey. Welcome back to the show, Jack.
Glad to be here.
Okay, so the Senate rejected a one-year delay of Obamacare, which was attached to a plan to fund the government just through December 15th anyways, right?
Right.
Everything's short-term and not happening. Anyway.
Well, what happens is that the federal spending year ended, and as a result, they had to pass what's known as a continuing resolution, which is gobbledygook for a temporary spending bill to keep the government open through the middle of December. Now, that was everybody's plan. They've never talked about passing a temporary spending bill that went any further than that, because mm-hmm. at that point, that would give them a chance to pass the rest of the appropriations bills. So that part was both sides wanted to do. But the a group of very hardy conservatives who are allied with the Tea Party decided to make their vote for a temporary spending bill contingent upon an overhaul, a defunding, whatever you want to call it, of the 2010 health care law, which is known as Obamacare. And to show how clever these people are, today the government is shut down and Obamacare is going into effect.
How long could this go on? How long would it have to persist to become really noticeable at this point?
Well, it goes on until someone cries uncle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is where this is in the 1995 shutdown, which lasted 21 days, and unfortunately, I'm old enough to have covered here. It lasted until many of the House Republicans came back and said, "Oh my gosh, my constituents are mad at me. They want to get their passports, and they want to go to monuments, and they want to do this, and they want to do that." And I had no idea they were going to get so mad at me. And so Bob Dole, who was then the Senate Majority Leader and was running for president, introduced a measure to open up the government. It is universally regarded as a tremendous blunder by the Republicans in 1995.
And yet, they did it again.
Yeah, well, that does. I have an old friend of mine who covered politics for years, and once when I asked a question similar to that, he looked at me and he said, "Jack, you know, they're not that smart."
One time someone said to me, "Ann, you think about this way too much." Okay, so they did it back in 1995. They were clobbered for it. We're going to get into the politics a lot deeper later, but just this contingent of Republicans that are kind of calling the shots apparently right now, are they a contingent that doesn't care as much about what their constituencies say about this, about the fact that they might be going to the Washington Monument today and now they are not going to get to see it? I mean, is this a different group?
Actually, people have argued that this is a more conservative group. I'm not so sure, because I thought the House Republicans in 1995 were about as conservative as you could get. I mean, people have now been writing that Newt Gingrich, who was then the Speaker, was reasonable. Listen, I've heard a lot of phrases attached to him, and reasonable is not one of them. I mean, you have to understand, this is the same group of people who decided it was a good idea to impeach President of the United States over an extramarital affair. And so that, I don't think they're more conservative today. I just think they're in such safe districts that the only thing they have to worry about is a challenge in the primaries from the far right. So the only way to guarantee that you never get challenged is to go as far right as you can. And the Tea Party groups, which are very determined, and I see them as a direct descendant of the Ross Perot voters in 92 and the Pat Buchanan voters in the 1996 primaries, they're very hostile or skeptical to the federal government, and they're very much opposed to the health care law. and they want this thing shut down. They think they have the power to do it, and they simply don't.
What does a shutdown really mean to most of us?
Well, most of you probably won't even notice it. And particularly at this time of year. For example, on Saturday, the House scheduled several hours of floor debate on C-SPAN on one of their latest offers to finance the government. And all I could think of was, wait a second, Ohio State's playing Wisconsin. There's college football games across the country. There's Major League Baseball games. There's a wild card race. Do they really think people are going to be watching C-SPAN? Of course not. Were you?
No.
All right. And if the Columbus Dispatch hadn't paid me to do so, I probably wouldn't have watched it either. So they are appealing, and both sides are doing this, to a very small sliver on the far right and the far left. And they have an outsized kick in American politics because the congressional districts are drawn in such a way that you almost – there's only 50 competitive districts now across the country. The rest of them, the only way you lose them is through a primary.
Right.
So if you're a Democrat, you're hearing from MoveOn.org and other progressive groups. And if you're in the right, you're hearing from the Heritage Foundation and you're hearing for the Club for Growth. And for those of us who've watched this development with mounting alarm, this is one of the horrible side effects of the McCain-Feingold law. Because the McCain-Feingold law made it essentially outlawed big donations to the political parties. Instead, those started getting funneled to independent organizations, single-issue organizations like the Club for Growth.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they now have a bigger say on how a lawmaker should vote than the parties. I always liked the old smoke-filled rooms that sort of thing, because I thought at least you ended up with people in Congress who had the same interest, which was to govern. And right now, I'm not so sure that we're seeing that.
You know, the small sliver on the right would be that contingent of the Tea Party wants to take this thing all the way, or people like Tea Party members, mm-hmm. such as they are, to the brink. On the left, though, I mean, the president was reelected after this law was passed, even though, you know, there's lots of different kinds of polls out there with all kinds of shades of gray about how the public feels about the law. He was reelected. Is he really speaking to that much of a sliver?
He's not speaking to that much of a sliver. And as a matter of fact, your point is well taken. This was a debate. We had this debate in the 2012 campaign. One candidate said he would repeal Obamacare. The other one said, I will make it work. The one who said he's going to make it work won. You know, elections matter. But to people who are very ideological, and I'm afraid that that's the type of person who's got more of a say in American politics today, those types of things don't matter as much. To them, it's a constant fight. Now, in fairness to them, the Democrats are reaping what they sowed in 2010. They rammed this law through on a basic party line vote. They never made any effort like Lyndon Johnson did in 1965 when he passed Medicare, or in 1964 when he passed the Civil Rights Bill, to get Republican support. There was never even a serious attempt to get it, and the Republicans weren't inclined to vote for it anyway. So this bill has always had half the country, you know, doubtful about it. And as a result, you still have people sort of, you know, not willing to buy into this law. And the fact of the matter is, we think it'll work, but we don't know that. I mean, it's just, we think these exchanges will work. We think the Medicaid provisions will work, but there's only one way to find out.
Right.
And like I said, the supreme irony of all this is that we have the government shut down over an attempt to end Obamacare, and Obamacare goes into effect today. And
yes.
At some point I thought, you know, is somebody on the House floor going to figure this out?
Well, I mean, we can talk about Obamacare till the cows come home. It would not be the first law that's been tweaked along the way to make it better.
No.
If it requires that, and already they've given something of a stay to some big companies to get things worked out for a year, but...
This is correct, and but here's the problem with that. The Republicans have no interest in tweaking the law. They want to get rid of it.
Right.
So they're not going to offer any help on that. I mean, there's no question. The Republicans are far more intransigent about this than the Democrats are. But the Democrats, you know, haven't gone out of their way to be helpful either. So you have kind of a double whammy here. I mean, these are types of things 30 years ago could have been, you know, compromised over a bourbon in Hugh Scott's back office in the Capitol. And today, I mean, I don't think these people talk much to each other.
Do they even know each other?
Well, I had one lobbyist. I asked him a couple of years ago. I said, what's the problem going on? He had worked in the Nixon White House. I said, what's the problem going on in Washington? He said, well, I don't think anybody drinks enough anymore.
All right. We know that most of us won't really feel it, at least not at first. But some people will be hurt by the shutdown immediately, right?
Yes. If you're a federal employee, you're going to get furloughed. And now,
does that include Congress?
No.
Okay.
No, no, no. Congress and some of their essential staff will continue working. But a lot of their staff members won't. There's tens of thousands of federal in the Washington, D.C. area. It's going to be a tremendous hit. But if you're in Columbus, you're looking at the defense facilities up in Whitehall, and they're facing a potential furlough. The military bases out at Wright-Patterson will not be affected with their military personnel. They're going to get paid. They're going to continue to operate and that sort of thing. But if you want to go and get a passport, you're not going to be able to get it processed right now. Your mail will still be delivered. You'll still get your Social Security checks. What really to me is the greater problem is the symbolism that the members of Congress and the White House simply cannot agree on an essential question of keeping the government open. That to me it's sending a terrible message to the rest of the world.
Charlotte in Columbus, you're on the air with Jack Turia of the Dispatch. Welcome, Charlotte.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Two quick observations. My landlord just picked up the rent check, and he's a moderate Republican. I come from a blue dog Democratic background, and I had to express my heartfelt thanks and my condolences to him for his party handing me 2014 on a silver platter. And the other thing, other than gerrymandered districts, and those gerrymandered districts in Ohio were not Ted Strickland's fault. And the other one was, I have a dear friend whose child was born with cerebral palsy. When her former employer went under, she hasn't had health insurance in 7 years. Her husband just had a triple bypass. After the rally on the State House lawn tomorrow, I'm taking her to lunch. And then we're going to go to the library to look up those exchanges to see what we can find to help her situation. So I just also want to thank Obamacare for what it hopes to do. And we'll iron out the bugs as we go along. But it's time that this country got sane. Bismarck figured this out over a century ago.
Okay. Thank you, Charlotte. Take care. My guest is Jack Turia, the Dispatch. We're talking about the federal government shutdown that took effect at midnight. Like Charlotte, if you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And email from Carl, I think we've already answered his question. Does Congress get their paychecks even with the government shutdown? Yes, they do.
That's my understanding.
Okay.
You know, I'm sure someone will call and say, you got that one wrong. And you know what? I'm operating on about 4 hours sleep.
And
so
I love on-air corrections, prefer them much more than the off-air corrections. So, all right, we'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Last week, Republican Speaker of the House John Boehner of Ohio told us what the American people want and what they don't want.
The American people don't want the government shut down, and they don't want Obamacare. Yeah.
Yeah. And when neither side budged, at midnight, the federal government closed for business. Still with us, Jack Torrey of the Columbus Dispatch joining us later. Jonathan Alter, former senior editor for Newsweek. Jack, I've seen the polls all over the place now. What do we know about what's reliable about what the American people really want? Because we already talked about, they did reelect the president.
They did reelect the president. There is no question, however, that there is a great deal of unease about the health care law. And I think that that will either increase or vanish once people see if and how it works. In many cases, there are going to be people going online today and finding access to insurance policies that they've never been able to afford. Some of those people, depending on how much money they make, will be eligible for federal subsidies. The number of Americans who will be covered will increase by about 20 to 25 million. And so you will see, if it does work, I think you're going to see a lot of the doubts and skepticism vanish. The other thing, too, is Americans by nature are fairly conservative. They're nervous about big changes. This law has never been well explained. It's a very complicated law. When they were arguing it in the Supreme Court, even the Solicitor General of the United States told the justice I wouldn't argue that this law is a model of clarity. And as a result, you know, if the Solicitor General of the United States is confused, it's not unreasonable that ordinary Americans will be confused. Your previous caller said she's going to go online and get insurance. And I think those people who are working Americans and who don't have access to health insurance right now, I think they're going to like this. But if the computers crash and they can't get things to work and Ann Fisher's premiums soar because you're adding 20 million people into the system, then maybe some people won't like it.
If voters blame Republicans for this shutdown, but don't feel the pain of a shutdown, will they necessarily punish the Republicans? You said that they were very hurt in 1995. And by the way, blame can also be changed to credited with. So people are happy about the shutdown.
I actually think it's in 1995, it did not necessarily punish congressional Republicans. They were able to recover, but it clearly kneecapped Bob Dole's presidential campaign. I mean, Bill Clinton was like dead man walking in 1995. He was having all kinds of trouble. You know, he was arguing that, you know, I'm still relevant. And what happened was people looked at the opponents and said, oh, my God, I mean, who are these people? How did they get in office? And it really hurt someone like Dole, who actually was a far more moderate mainstream Republican, but he got tied into the government shutdown. And it sort of, you know, portrayed him as part of that fairly conservative Republican group. So you're going to sit there in 2016 and you're going to see, you know, Ted Cruz of Texas almost certainly run for the Iowa caucuses. I mean, the reason behind his strategy is to win the Iowa caucuses in 2016. Mm-hmm. He is not under any illusions, unless he's really dumb. I mean, he's not under any illusions that this was going to defund the health care law. The health care law is going into effect. And it's either going to work or it's not going to work. And there are some Republican strategists who've told me all week, said, we don't think this is going to work. We got to just sit there and watch it collapse on its own. And instead, they've gotten in the wave. So we'll see what happens there.
Have Democrats ever tried anything like this?
Look, both sides play hardball. Mm-hmm. This is Washington. You're talking about people who on both sides who are very, very committed to the way they see the world. And compromise has become sort of a lost art here. But in my time, I have not seen the Democrats shut down the government. I've seen the Democrats do things that made me sort of shake my head. I remember in 1989, Senator Majority Leader George Mitchell, who I thought was one of the best at his job, used a filibuster to kill the a cut in the capital gains tax, which I thought was like using a nuclear bomb to kill a gnat. But the fact is, the Republicans have played this far tougher. And it's a band of about 20 to 60 House Republicans who come from very conservative districts. And they have very strong support from Tea Party people, from the Club for Growth, the Heritage Foundation, people like that. And I think half of them are delighted today. They think they're going to win.
Graham in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome, Graham.
Hi. Just a couple of quick comments. One, you mentioned about the Wright Patterson. Whilst the military are in, my daughter is a civilian employee there, and they're at this moment in time closing things down. They were saying that the timekeeping system is chock-a-block at the moment, with everybody trying to put their stuff in at the moment, and they're not able to enter their time. Something else about the Whitehall, one of the areas that I don't know if this is going to be shut down, but remember that DFAS is the major payer system for all defense contractors in the country and the world. And if that shuts down, then that tremendously affects the payment of money to contractors, which are also tremendously affected. I mean, there's a huge defense contracting industry that is now, unless it's deemed absolutely essential or accepted, then that has no income coming in. And a lot of people being left laid off there. As I work for a defense contractor, I know that as well.
Because they need that money flow.
Correct. It doesn't hurt the major corporations, the big ones, the Lockheed Martins and the Boeings and such like, but the smaller companies are very badly affected by this and very quickly as well.
Okay. All right, Graham.
And then one quick final comment, question. Because of the effects of gerrymandering, which does things on a micro level, and then presidential elections on a macro level, I've had this discussion with other people. The contention is that we have seen the last Republican presidents for a long time. Thoughts, comments, I'll listen offline.
All right, Graham, thank you for your call. Jack Torrey, thoughts, comments?
In five of the past six presidential elections, the Republican nominee has not received 50% of the vote. That, to me, is a message. People don't like what the brand of soap they're getting sold. The only time a Republican in the last six elections got more than 50% was George W. Bush in 2004, and he received 50.8. But the parties are very polarized, and the nominees are more worried about their base than trying to get the great unwashed in the middle, because the people in the middle do not participate in primaries. A perfect example of that is in 2006. Jim Petro would have been a stronger general election candidate against Ted Strickland.
For governor, right?
For governor. Instead, the conservatives nominated Ken Blackwell. I think he got, you could check this, 36% of the vote. Well, that means if 64% of the state's voting against your nominee, you got a bad message and you have to refine it. So 4 years later, they nominated a stronger candidate, John Kasich, and even then he didn't get 50% of the vote, but he was a much stronger candidate than Ken Blackwell. So as a result, people on the far right and the far left can nominate people, but they can't always elect them. Now, eventually the Republicans are going to figure this out. They'll get somebody elected someday, but I don't know when. And on the course they're headed right now, I don't see it happening anytime soon. But the one thing about American politics is nothing is permanent. In the 1980s, there were people who would have told you the Democrats will never win a presidential election. Well, they did win it because Bill Clinton in 1992 not only had the advantage of running in a three-way race against a very weak incumbent, but he also made strong appeals to the middle. And those appeals were sold to, you know, American voters accepted that. In 2008, Barack Obama basically said, I'm going to end this craziness in Washington. And I want to make things work, et cetera, et cetera. And people like to hear that. So the fact is, nothing in American politics is permanent, but it's going to take somebody of incredible ability in the Republican Party to unite these two factions, because right now the real internal war is going on in the Republican Party.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. The government, federal government has shut down. About 800,000 people will be furloughed, 400,000, I think, immediately. My guest is Jack Torrey, Washington Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch. Speaking of things changing, which you said is the constant, the president said that the Republicans can't go after the deficit anymore because it's plunged by something, I don't know, over 30% since the beginning of the year, and that's why they're fighting over the stopgap budget. How much did it hurt the Republicans that the president, or at least during the president's time in office, has seen that the deficit has been reduced so significantly?
Well, I'm not sure it really, because the people who know the budget numbers know that this is not going to last. I mean, we're on an unsustainable course. I think Herb Stein, who was President Nixon's chief economic advisor, was famous for saying, if it's not sustainable, it's not sustainable. Mm-hmm. Sort of like the John Maynard Keynes line, which is, in the long run, we're all dead.
So you're saying that the deficit will start to inch up fast enough?
Because too many baby boomers, you're not old enough to be a baby boomer.
But
I am. Mm-hmm. And people like myself and our good friend Bill Hershey, we will be retiring. And we have this huge number of retirees going into the Social Security and Medicare system. And the costs are just going to continue going up. And either the government's going to have to figure out a way to control health care costs, which they've shown a stunning inability to do, or they're going to have to figure out a way either to trim benefits or raise taxes. You cannot continue on the course we're on. So right now, the improving economy combined with the tax increase that went into effect at the beginning of this year, the tax increase on families making $450 and above, that has had an effect on the deficit. But by historical standards, this is a monster deficit. And had the Republicans decided to go after something more concrete, which is what actually the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, wanted to use the threat of the debt ceiling, which expires at the middle of this month, to sort of force the president into a grand bargain on the budget. That has been shelved because instead they pursued this illusory goal of trying to defund a law that is not going to get defunded, and there's nothing they can do about that.
An email from Phil. The message that the Democrats did not compromise ignores the Romney Care roots of the law, which could easily have been a single payer. The GOP has never had any goal but to humiliate Obama.
I think, and that's not being entirely fair, because what you also are seeing is the country is polarized on very strong ideological grounds. This is an ideological debate, and there are people who have very strong views on this. And so I, you know, it's easy for somebody in the Democratic Party to say this is about humiliating Obama, but it's more complicated than that. And secondly, we have not seen – I mean, nobody is ever going to accuse Barack Obama of being Lyndon Johnson when it comes to dealing with Congress. I mean, he's just – he's been detached from Congress. He has no great relationships with them. And this time, I mean, he's basically been a non-factor in this entire debate. It's been the Senate Democratic leader, Harry Reid from Nevada, who has taken the lead on this. So as a result, it may not make a nice sound bite, but the fact of the matter is these are very deep ideological disputes. But what the troubling thing is the unwillingness of one side to accept both the results of election and a law. Yes.
Tom in Miami County. Tom in Miami County, you're on the air. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Hey, I had a couple of comments to make. Number one, early in it, Jack remarked that people voted for Obama on a second term, knowing what the law was. Well, hey, he got 9 million less votes in 2012 than he did in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one who refused to negotiate. Remember a couple of weeks ago, I will not negotiate.
Mm-hmm. Not about Obamacare.
He refuses to negotiate.
About Obamacare.
That's right.
Not about everything.
Well,
just about that.
He hasn't negotiated on hardly anything.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing, the whole Obamacare idea. I was a licensed insurance agent for 49 years.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an old geezer, way past where anybody looks at. I'm 80 years old. But insurance is people sharing losses. You cannot write fire insurance on houses that are on fire. You must have a number of them that are standing safely.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody chips into the pot, and those who get hurt take it out.
Mm-hmm.
The principle of this health insurance deal is we're going to go ahead and force the healthy young ones in. Now, the reason our system worked in the past was that we had employer-based insurance. We had people working. And part of the employee benefit was health insurance. And the majority of people there were healthy because they were working. So now we come up here, we have a high number unemployed, partly because of government policies, partly because of the way the world is. And you're trying to go ahead and get people who are not making money to buy insurance at what I saw quoted in the Dayton News the other day. Was at four times what it had been before.
Well, the people that are not making money, I thought were, correct me if I'm wrong, Jack Tory, but isn't that what, I mean, if you're not making money, you don't pay as much, or if anything.
Right. If you're unemployed, for example, you have access in other ways to insurance. The problem we have in our country, it's people who are working for companies that don't insure their workers. And there's a number of small, medium-sized companies that don't. And so as a result, you have a smaller pool of workers than you would normally have. On his other point about younger people, part of the reason this law is to make it work is to get young people into the younger, healthier people into the insurance system.
Mm-hmm.
The problem you have there is, you know, I remember what I was like at age 25. I didn't have health insurance, and I couldn't have cared less. I wasn't going to die at age 25. If I got a cold, I just stayed home for a day or two. And health insurance just is not as important for people in their early 20s to late 20s. So as a result, you're trying to get more of those people in the system because they're very healthy, and it balances off the people like myself who are older and probably need more access to a doctor.
You know, I was the same way as you until a very close relative about my same age became deathly ill and was uninsured and ended up with just extreme, this was back 30 years ago, extreme debt because of it.
That's true. And
so I got whatever you call it, major medical or, you know, for the the catastrophe.
Actually, I've often been puzzled why the government didn't just try to get companies to mandate companies to offer catastrophic coverage to their employees, because the things that most people in their younger years worry about is, you know, they'll end up with some horrific disease and it'll cost them a fortune. But that's, unfortunately, we're headed right now toward this toward a system where it's kind of a little bit of a one-size-fits-all type
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking with Jack Tory, Washington Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch. Coming up, Jonathan Alter, former senior editor for Newsweek, columnist and commentator. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Late last night, here's what House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi had to say about the faction responsible for the gridlock and shutdown in the federal government.
They don't believe in government. They're anti-government ideologues who are, it's the Tea Party shutdown of government. Mm.
And Speaker of the House John Boehner said late yesterday, however, that he hopes for a compromise on Capitol Hill.
The Senate has continued to reject our offers. But under the Constitution, there's a way to resolve this process, and that is to go to conference and talk through your differences.
Still with me, Jack Torrey of the Washington Bureau for the Columbus Dispatch. And joining us now is Jonathan Alter, former senior editor for Newsweek. He's a columnist and political analyst and author. We talked with him this summer about his latest book, The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thanks very much.
So is this a colossal game of chicken now? And what are your predictions about who blinks?
Well, first of all, my predictions aren't any better than anybody else's, and nobody really knows, what's going to happen. I saw a couple of senators yesterday on the Democratic side of the aisle, and they didn't have a clue as to how this was going to play out. There are a couple of things that are different from other government shutdowns, and we have had them in the past, not just in 1995, but going back to the 1970s, they would occasionally, I think on more than a dozen occasions, have government shutdowns of a day or so. But in those cases, each side, each party had certain priorities, certain budget priorities that they were haggling over at the 11th hour. It wasn't on a matter of deep ideology the way this one is. In this case, you really only have one side that has demands. The Democrats don't have any demands. All they want is to move on and keep the government open. The Republicans have demands, and those demands are to essentially reverse the effects of a presidential election and reopen. They say to litigate for the first time, but it's been litigated for the last 4 years, including all the way to the Supreme Court. They want to relitigate Obamacare. Well, that is a very extraordinary thing. We haven't in the past revisited past legislation, settled law. That's what this is about. So what they're doing, I would argue, is almost extra constitutional. It's outside the normal bounds that we've been operating on, outside the playing lines. And the only way it's going to end, I think, is for John Boehner to fall on his sword and agree to let the House vote. This is another thing that is not very well understood right now. All that's standing in the way of reopening the government is letting the House vote. Because if the question of whether to shut the government was brought before the entire House, it would lose. And a combination of Democrats and significantly less radical, slightly less conservative Republicans would carry the day. And let me amend that. They're not actually less conservative. They're just more reasonable. There are people like Tom Coburn in the Senate and a number of Republicans in the House who have almost perfect conservative voting records who think this is an idiotic idea. And it's being driven by a group of radical Republicans who are getting their campaigns funded, raising huge amounts of money, securing themselves against even more conservative primary challenges. And they have hijacked our system, about 30 of them.
How long can this go on?
Well, there's different estimates. I just a few minutes ago got off MSNBC. I was on with a conservative commentator. He thought it would go all the way through the debt ceiling fight a few weeks off. I think it's more likely to get settled in a week, but he probably has better sources inside the right wing than I do. So it might be that this goes on into late October.
Jack Torrey?
I would agree. I think the problem is as we've talked about, is not only is this a deep ideological dispute, but the political parties are almost homogenized in the way they're so the Republicans who 40 years ago when Richard Nixon was president, who would support the creation of the EPA, who would support extension of health insurance to working Americans, That party doesn't exist anymore. This is a very conservative, anti-government group. And I would agree with Jonathan when he says, when he's talking about Tom Coburn. I mean, this is not anything other than a very conservative lawmaker. But there are people who understand the reality of how to make a law. I mean, as I pointed out, you have the supreme irony that today the government is shut down and Obamacare is going into effect. And I'm waiting for someone, you know, in the Ted Cruz faction to figure that out. And I just don't think they will, because you know, Senator Cruz wants to run for president. This is the way to win the Iowa caucuses in 2016, and that's what this is about. And as a result, he and his good buddies over at the Heritage Foundation have kind of ginned up a crisis that should have never existed. Had the Republicans decided we want to settle on a couple of budgetary items, like, for example, the medical device tax, they might have been able to actually win on that. But this grand scheme of trying to defund a law that has been upheld by the courts, that the voters confirmed in 2012 against Mitt Romney. I mean, this is just sort of it's gnashing of teeth and it's wasting time.
Jonathan Alter, when you talk about John Boehner falling on his sword, what would that? I mean, putting it to a vote and so forth. What would be the damage to Boehner?
Well, I don't know precisely, but this to me is the nub of it. This is all about John Boehner. It's, at this point, it's really not about Ted Cruz anymore. It's about John Boehner and what kind of a man is he. So the key fact about Boehner's history, which has not been discussed at all, maybe in the Columbus Dispatch it has been, it probably has been in the Ohio Press, but not so much in newspapers elsewhere and on television elsewhere, is what happened to him in the 1990s. He was in the leadership under Newt Gingrich, and he lost his leadership position to a guy named J.C. Watts, an African-American congressman from Oklahoma. The party at that time thought it would be a good idea to have the only African-American Republican in the leadership. Boehner was out, unceremoniously dumped from his post. That is a very, very hard thing for a politician to experience. Usually it marks the end of their career. They resign from Congress and go home. Boehner chose a harder path, which was to fight back, and he, over a period of years, very skillfully clawed his way back into the leadership and eventually became speaker. So but he was, you know, politically traumatized by that experience, and the last thing he wants is to be dumped. But the only way to reopen the government is to be a responsible leader, somebody who's actually committed to governing, not just posturing, and bring it up for a vote before the full House. That's the right thing to do, not to use his, you know, his parliamentary tricks to prevent it from coming up for a vote, but just simply to allow it to come up for a vote. And I think every time Boehner holds a little briefing, he needs to be asked, not, you know, how is this going to play out and, you know, what do you think of Harry Reid, but when will you let the basic question of opening or continuing to close the government come before the full House? That's what the people expect. That's, most people think it works that way. All these parliamentary games they play in the Senate with cloture and 60 votes this and, you know, filibustering that, and in the House with scheduling or not scheduling, that's just white noise to the American public. They reasonably don't understand why at least it can't come up for a vote. But I think if he does that, and he brings it up for a vote, and he loses, and the Republicans lose, which would happen, or the very conservative Republicans would lose, at that point they will get together and they will dump him. So he would then go down, you know, as a profile in courage for being willing to do the right thing. But I don't know, given the trauma of what happened to him in the 1990s, I don't know whether he's capable of doing it. It's a character test for John Boehner in the next couple of weeks.
It definitely explains a little bit why he was so emotional when he was elected Speaker of the House. Jack, I covered him a little bit in the state legislature. He mostly just sat in committee, didn't say much, and smoked cigarettes. But what do you know about John Boehner and what he's capable of doing at this point?
Well, first of all, John is a deal maker. All right. The problem he's got is there's very few people to make a deal
with. They don't make deals in Washington anymore.
No. I mean, he can't make a deal with his right wing. I just find the Obama White House to be unable to deal with Congress in any grown-up way. I thought it was very telling that during the fiscal cliff crisis, Mitch McConnell had to call Joe Biden in somewhat earthy language, said, does anybody up there know how to make a deal?
Yeah.
So you have that problem. Secondly, I think his experience in 1998 when he was thrown out, I think that is a major factor. But a House Speaker has to operate on a slightly different plane than other people here. It's very hard to cross your party. Now, eventually what's going to happen is he will put some sort of a clean CR on the floor and everybody will vote for it. But that's going to take a while. And I think his original plan was to let the Republicans get this all out of their system. And what screwed it all up was Ted Cruz delaying everything in the Senate. This ping-ponging back and forth was supposed to take place last week. It wasn't supposed to take place over the weekend. But Ted Cruz decided to stand up on the floor, and I'm trying to avoid the word grandstanding because I'm not a columnist per se, but he stood up on the floor for 21 hours.
It's a factual matter. It's okay.
But he sort of screwed it up. I mean, I told you earlier, Tom Corologos, who was one of Nixon's lobbyists and Reagan's lobbyists, I asked him a couple of years ago, I said, what's the problem up there? He says, well, you don't drink enough. He said, I used to go up there in the afternoon with a bottle of bourbon, and Hugh Scott and I and a few other guys would sit around, and in a couple hours we'd have a deal.
Well, it was helpful to journalists, too, and a lot of people are critical of how journalists are covering this thing as if it's a normal thing that's happening.
This is not normal. This is extremely abnormal. This is extremely damaging for the country, and it's extremely damaging for the country internationally.
So what's it like at these press, you know, where they meet with the press and they stand up and make their statements? Jonathan Alter said earlier, if someone would just ask him, when are you going to do this? Does anybody ask him?
You know, I'm convinced somebody probably has. I just don't recall it off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've reached the point. I mean, Michael Steele, one of his John Boehner's PR guys, was briefing reporters the other day, and Janet Hook, who's one of the best people on Capitol Hill for the Wall Street Journal, she said something about Speaker Cruz. Because, you know, he's got a big kick in the Republican caucus. So my guess is eventually what will happen is Boehner will decide when the point's been made and the damage to his party has been bad enough. He did this during the fiscal cliff. He put that bill out on the floor knowing that 60 to 80 Republicans were going to vote against it. But he said the damage has been done. And in retrospect, actually, Boehner and McConnell cut a pretty good deal on the fiscal cliff. I mean, the tax increases were limited to people making $450 and above, families. And so as a result, it turned out to be a pretty good deal. But when you're dealing with very ideological people, they're not worried about that type of thing.
One thing they still are worried about, though, is fundraising. This has been quite a heyday for fundraising, right, Jonathan?
Yeah. They're, a lot of this is about positioning for 2014. Thinking about somebody like Michael Steele, who, by the way, is not the former chairman of the RNC, but an aide to Speaker Boehner, and I've dealt with people in their office, and these guys are pragmatic deal cutters, but they often, and they're right to some extent about the Obama White House's ham-handedness in dealing with the Hill, but that still doesn't get them from A to B. They still have to make the fundamental decision about whether
something.
They're willing to buck the extreme part of the Republican Party. Boehner has, I mean, he worked with Ted Kennedy on No Child Left Behind. He's reached across the aisle many times in the past, but he has not figured out a way to live with the banana Republicans. And he needs to do that.
We're going to have to end it there. Jonathan Alter, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks. It was great.
And also Jack Turia of the Dispatch. Thank you as well. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.